difficulties have largely stemmed from the fact that this is serial number one. Nothing like this has ever been built for the Arctic, and really, for that matter, anywhere in the world.
Shell weathers additional setbacks to their Arctic drilling plans. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Department of Defense considers where to make cuts.
There is a reasonably strong potential that Congress may take up and favorably take action on approval for a BRAC round in calendar year 2013.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Shell will not drill for oil this summer as originally planned. The company will drill several top hole wells this year, but as APRN's Peter Granitz reports, technical failures are preventing them from drilling down thousands of feet to oil-rich levels.
Shell has suffered a series of technical setbacks. The most recent one occurred early Saturday morning in Puget Sound. Pete Slaby, vice president of Shell Alaska, says a containment dome required for mitigating a spewing well suffered damages during a test. Slaby says he cannot elaborate on what precisely is wrong with the containment dome or how serious the damages are because of a company investigation. But he did say the repairs will need to be done on shore.
I think we were literally to a place where we had just about timed ourselves out. And when we look at the need to do the investigation, coupled with whatever, you know, the repair window is, it looked like moving forward just would not be feasible with respect to drilling into hydrocarbon sections.
The company will continue drilling top holes, the 1,400 feet deep upper sections of the wells. The Department of Interior has granted approval for that operation. It has yet to okay Shell's bid for drilling deeper into oil beds. Slaby says the company will need to modify its application to drill deeper, and they will not be approved until the containment system passes all inspections from the Department of Interior. He says he recognizes the technical problems the Arctic Challenger vessel has faced throughout the process.
Difficulties have largely stemmed from the fact that this is serial number one. Nothing like this has ever been built for the Arctic, and really, for that matter, anywhere in the world.
Environmental groups welcomed Shell's decision. Cindy Shogan directs the Alaska Wilderness League and says, more than anything, she's relieved. But the effort isn't done.
We're still also waiting to see what the administration will say about their proposal to drill in the Beaufort, which we know they're waiting till the end of the whaling season. But I think given what's been going on, the administration should say no to that. Let's wait till next year and let's make sure we do it right.
And that's the message Shell is touting as well. Safety first. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Legislators today started looking at what might be in the state's future when Congress decides it's time to reorganize the nation's military. The Joint Armed Services Committee also heard some ideas to avoid concerns over any possible negative results from the next Federal Base Realignment and Closure, or BRAC, commission. Steve Hijack, the state's Washington, D.C.-based consultant on BRAC matters, assured lawmakers that he doesn't see anything arising in the immediate future, although the Secretary of Defense has requested a formal commission to help cut his budget.
There is a reasonably strong potential that Congress may take up and favorably take action on approval for a BRAC round in calendar year 2013. The Secretary of Defense will push hard for a 2015 BRAC. There are those political pundits who believe it'll be 2017, and we'll just have to wait to see how that plays out.
Hijack says his recommendations due out in a formal report next month will be for Alaska to promote its centralized location for deployment of troops and equipment to any part of the world. He says the strategic value of keeping the military here needs to get beyond what he calls the green eye shades of the accountants who will recommend the first cuts to military installations. But he says one certain area the legislature needs to address is the cost of energy at the state's bases.
I don't know what the cost would be to the state to offer discounted power, and if it's not going to provide a significant savings, and when I mean significant, you know, anywhere between 8 to 10% or more, I'm not going to encourage us to just bite around the edges and expend the taxpayers' dollars. But I would certainly say discounted power as a short-term bridge will likely be a recommendation of something that I think the state should look at in the near term as an action.
He says lawmakers should not confuse the idea of discounted power with the possibility of changing fuel sources, such as swapping coal generation for natural gas generators. The cost of changing fuels brings up new costs and issues that he is not prepared to analyze. The final base closing and reorganization decisions are based on established statutory criteria, such as whether a facility supports the fighting operations of the military and the actual cost of operating and staffing the facility. He says the economic impact on the local community is at the bottom of the Defense Department's points for consideration. The same storm that left relatively little damage in Anchorage hit parts of the interior hard. Golden Valley Electric Association crews have been working since early this morning repairing power lines damaged by wind-felled trees. KUAC's Tim Ellis has more.
Winds in excess of 70 miles an hour ripped through the interior again Sunday, the second such windstorm in 10 days. GVEA spokeswoman Cassandra Cerny says the utility has seven crews working to restore power to as many as 1,000 homes around the interior.
Delta Junction, Nenana, North Pole, Salcha, and then Northern Fairbanks, so Chena Hot Springs Road, Gold Mine Trail were the most heavily hit.
Cerny said at 9 this morning that GVEA officials didn't yet have an exact number on how many homes were without power and when electricity would be restored.
We're estimating about 500 to 1,000 members are still without power. But again, some people may not have called in yet. So we don't know.
The situation was as bad, if not worse, around Tok. Alaska Power and Telephone spokesman Mark McCready says reports from AP&T workers around the Tok area report that the storm caused widespread damage to the utility's system and the town and nearby communities.
Half the town of Tok is out of power. They said Tanacross was horrifically damaged as far as people's homes and cars turned over. And they said Tanacross seemed to almost be an epicenter of some kind of, I don't know whether it's a micro tornado or what. They said we had poles torn out of the ground and thrown 20 feet in spots.
McCready says AP&T is calling in crews from around the state. He doesn't expect repairs to be completed for at least 2 weeks. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
The weekend's predicted big storm in the Anchorage area didn't hit as hard as the storm 2 weeks earlier, but heavy rainfall from Talkeetna to Seward has caused many South Central creeks to overflow their banks and has raised concerns of flooding. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Anchorage residents prepared for another big wind event on Saturday and Sunday, but mostly all they got was rain, lots of rain. And rain fell heavy in the Matanuska Valley, north to Talkeetna, and south on the Kenai Peninsula. All that rain has caused flood watches, some of which are still in effect. Scott Walden is emergency services manager for the Kenai Peninsula Borough. He says Seward dodged a bullet during the latest storm. Walden says no significant flooding problems have occurred there, but Kenai Peninsula Borough emergency services are preparing for bad weather to come. In the Matanuska Sioux Sitna Borough, some minor flooding occurred in the Moose Creek and Trapper Creek areas, but no injuries or evacuations were reported. Matsu Borough Emergency Services Manager Dennis Broudigan says watches continue for the Talkeetna and Little Susitna Rivers, as well as for local creeks, which have reached the tops of their banks.
We are anticipating that another storm will be moving in tomorrow. There are varied reports on the strength of the storm, but the ground is saturated, and those rivers typically that flood first are, again, the Moose Creek, Trapper Creek area, as well as Montana Creek, Willow Creek, and perhaps even the Talkeetna River.
In Anchorage, flood warnings were canceled by late Sunday night for the city's Chester Creek and Westchester Lagoon. As far as the expected high winds were concerned, they only materialized at certain points in the Anchorage area. Bear Valley, south of the city, was hit the hardest, with some gusts clocked at 120 miles an hour.
This last storm was pretty intense up there in Bear Valley, and it was really, really blowing.
That's Bear Valley homeowner Marcus Hartley. Hartley says the winds of this latest storm were even stronger than during the storm of September 4th and 5th.
It was pretty noticeable Saturday evening. It wasn't terribly bad in the early evening, but it got pretty bad the later you got. And then Sunday morning, maybe I thought was some of the higher winds.
Some area electric companies reported minor outages in a few neighborhoods Sunday evening. Anchorage's Municipal Light and Power had no reports of interrupted service, while Chugach Electric Association and Matanuska Electric Association reported isolated incidents on Sunday. As of Monday morning, service had been restored to all but a few homes. So far, no casualties have been reported as a result of the storm. An Eagle River man inexplicably kayaking on the flood-swollen Eagle River on Sunday afternoon had to be rescued when his kayak became pinned against a partially submerged log. The man barely had his head above water when rescue crews had to use a chainsaw to cut the log and pull the man to safety. The hypothermic man, who was not identified, is recovering in an Anchorage hospital. Now, with two major storm events behind them, city residents are bracing for another round of wind and rain, which could start late Monday night. National Weather Service forecasts for the coming storm are not predicting the exact track of the storm, but are certain that more rain will begin tonight or early Tuesday. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, avalanche experts from around the world trade information in Anchorage.
Colorado has more avalanche fatalities since the 1950s, but Alaska is number two in that statistic, and that's for overall.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers competitive interest rates with programs tailored for first-time home buyers and home choice seminars that cover the details of purchasing and financing a home. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Era Aviation has resumed some limited service in Alaska after the commuter airline grounded 12 airplanes over the weekend. Airline spokesman Steve Smith says flights this morning were being routed by dispatchers to provide service to those most affected by the weekend grounding. The planes were grounded after Federal Aviation Administration officers determined cockpit voice recorders were out of date and needed to be upgraded. Era says high winds also affected some flights. Some passengers were put up in Anchorage hotels and others were put on other carriers to continue their flights. ERA serves a number of Alaska communities. The federal investigation stems from an incident this month when an ERA plane traveling from Anchorage to Homer dropped 5,000 feet before pilots regained control. A youth homeless shelter project in Fairbanks has been delayed. The organization Fairbanks Youth Advocates is working to turn a donated downtown apartment building into a place to provide short-term housing and meals for homeless kids. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The faith-based nonprofit Fairbanks Youth Advocates has a $720,000 federal grant through the city to renovate the apartment building. Executive Director Mary Lee Bates says grant constraints, including engineering and other required reports, have extended the project timeline.
We were hoping to open this winter, as in January, and really what we're looking at is maybe something a year from now, so next fall. So it's just delayed the time quite a bit.
The shelter project involves tearing down and reconstructing the 1950s era apartment building and turning it into a safe house for kids between the ages of 12 and 17. The shelter will offer short-term care and counseling with the aim of reuniting young people with family. Bates says the shelter project delay forced the organization to turn down operational grants from the state, but they aren't giving up on doing something this winter.
When we shared with a lot of our partner agencies and the agencies that we're working with in the community that there would be a delay in the opening of the shelter, they all said, they gave a similar response, which was, no, wait, we have to do something. So we just really decided to take a serious look at this, and we looked at some other communities across the nation.
Bates says many cities tap a network of partners who provide off-hours space to house homeless kids. Three local entities, including First Presbyterian Church, are working on a similar temporary arrangement for Fairbanks. Bates says it's important because need increases as fall progresses.
Right now we're getting calls from other agencies in the community that have a client or have a student or, you know, they know of a young person in need and they're calling to see what's available. So the sooner we can provide some emergency shelter, then the sooner we can begin serving young people and keep them connected, keep them safe, and, you know, get them back on their feet.
Fairbanks' homeless youth population is hard to track, but is estimated to be in the hundreds at any one time. Fairbanks Counseling and Adoption receives multiple calls a week in winter from runaway or homeless youth in need of emergency housing. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Liquefied natural gas was on the minds of energy business executives, community leaders, and state lawmakers as they met at the first ever Alaska LNG Summit in Valdez last week. KCHU's Tony Gorman reports.
Alaska Gas Port Authority General Counsel Bill Walker believes the state needs to tap into its LNG resources as soon as possible before the window closes. Recent talks of a possible LNG line have heated up. Where that line would run is another question. The Parks Highway, Cook Inlet, and the Kenai Peninsula have all been tossed around, but to some, Valdez is the obvious choice.
Well, I think it's not so much Valdez needs to come here, it's the assets in place in Valdez.
Valdez Mayor Dave Cobb says the city already has the infrastructure in place to take on another pipeline.
You have a pipeline corridor that was permitted for 10 lines. You have an existing oil pipeline, which you could build a gas pipeline beside it. We've got the dock infrastructure. We've got the ship escort response vessel system. We've got the tug escorts. We've got the pilots saying that this is the best ice free port in Alaska.
The city of Valdez, who organized the event, wasn't the only rural Alaska community who felt it would economically benefit from having an LNG line. Rural Alaska mayors spoke their minds about how LNG would help their respective communities deal with high energy costs and outward migration. After a recent feasibility study determined his community could potentially save up to 65% on energy costs, Mayor Dr. Joseph Klaka said Bethel is looking at ways to bring LNG to the area.
There has been some talk about bringing liquefied natural gas over from the Yukon, shipping it down the Yukon and bringing it across on a proposed road system going across and then bringing it down the Kuskokwim River, which would be really delightful for us. I don't know how far off that is or if that's a real possibility, but we're certainly looking at it.
Another market that is looking at LNG to help high energy costs isn't in the state. Alaska officials have been talking with others on possibly exporting it to Hawaii.
It's not a simple equation because you can't just sort of drop off a little bit of LNG on your way to someplace else.
Barbara Treat is the program manager for the Hawaii LNG program. She says Hawaii has no problem working with Alaska, but thinks a serious plan needs to be in place before they can move forward.
You know, when you get serious, there are long lead times that you're going to need to know well in advance who your buyers are going to be, and we need to know well in advance who our suppliers are going to be, because there's a lot of investment to be made in the infrastructure, and there are a lot of decisions that need to be made.
The Alaska LNG Summit also featured presentations from the Alaska Congressional Delegation, business executives, and the Coast Guard. Walker felt the presentations made it loud and clear that an LNG line should go through Valdez.
I think we definitely got the message across and the opportunity of the, you know, the infrastructure. I mean, you know, Commander Hawkins did a great job talking about the vessel traffic system in Valdez and how unique it is. It's the only one in Alaska like it. And so this infrastructure would have to be replicated someplace else, you know, if they're going to go someplace else. So this is definitely where it should be. And I thought it was day one. I think the group hit it out of the park. I really do.
Next week, Walker is slated to speak at the Alaska Oil and Gas Congress and at the North American Gas Conference in D.C. next month. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Project Management Institute will present 3 one-day seminars at the Petroleum Club of Anchorage, October 9th, 10th, and 11th. Expert Neil Whitten will present no-nonsense advice for successful projects, Let's Talk, more no-nonsense advice for project success, and The Gift of Wisdom, Work-Life Balance for Today's Managers, Learn to Manage Projects, and more. Registration information at pmiak.org. This message sponsored by Project Management Institute, Alaska Chapter.
The 10th Annual Seafood Summit wrapped up last week in Hong Kong. Alaska freelance reporter and publisher of the newsletter Laws of the Sea, Bob Takach, was there. Takach says he spent 4 days touring aquaculture facilities, both for finfish and shrimp. He says as demand grows from India, China, Brazil, and other countries, wild fish stocks will not be enough.
Demand for seafood is such that everybody in the business, it's clear that aquaculture is the only future there is for seafood. If the average person is going to want to be able to buy a reasonably priced piece of seafood in another 20 years or so.
Takach says the operations he visited were clean and professional, and the quality was good. He says some of the problems of sea lice and antibiotic use still exist, but he says sustainability was the key word at the summit, and large international buyers are pushing for a more business-directed, sustainable approach with seafood aquaculture farm operations. Avalanche professionals from around the world are meeting in Anchorage this week for the International Snow Science Workshop. The meeting is a chance for self-described snow geeks to trade the latest information on avalanche science. APRN's Annie Feit has the story.
It's a different type of crowd for the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. Instead of suits and serious-looking business attire, there's a lot more practical clothing around, like fleece and Gore-Tex. Take Bruce Edgerly, for example. He's standing at a display booth in the third-floor atrium, wearing jeans and a flannel shirt.
I'm from Backcountry Access. We make avalanche rescue equipment. We're based in Colorado.
Edgerly is showing off the company's fleet of avalanche airbags. They're backpacks that have an inflatable bag inside to help a skier or snow machiner float on top of an avalanche. Edgerly demonstrates how they work by pulling a stout-looking cord on a backpack strap.
Okay, so just pull down.
As soon as he pulls the cord, a bright orange bag inside the backpack inflates. Edgerly says he's been skiing with an airbag pack for 3 years. He says the technology has been around for several decades, but it's gotten a lot better recently, and they're starting to catch on. An airbag setup costs at least $600, but Edgerly says they're saving lives.
Your chances are going to be much greater of surviving if you stay on top, or even if you just reduce the burial depth. Burial depth is a very, very important factor in the survivability of an avalanche. So if you can reduce that or eliminate that, you're really, really increasing your chances of surviving.
But the Snow Science Workshop isn't just a showcase for the latest avalanche technology. It's a meeting of the minds in a very specialized world that includes scientists, heli-ski guides, ski patrollers, and highway forecasters. Carl Berkland is an avalanche scientist at the U.S. Forest Service's National Avalanche Center in Bozeman, Montana. He says the conference brings together knowledgeable professionals from many different industries.
I mean, just this morning we saw talks ranging from, you know, helicopter skiing guides talking about how the snow feels under their feet and how they could check the snow with their probes, all the way to research scientists who are looking at every single parameter in an avalanche and trying to predict how far that avalanche will run out using computer models. So you see the entire range of things at this conference, and that's what makes it so great.
Berkland oversees a network of 14 National Forest Service avalanche forecasting centers in the western U.S. One of those centers is located in Girdwood and provides avalanche forecasts for the Turnagain Arm area. Berkland says the number of centers has increased around the country along with the number of backcountry users, and he says they're helping keep the avalanche fatality rate relatively low.
What we've seen in the amount of backcountry use is just an explosive increase in the amount of backcountry use. So while the backcountry use is just taking off like crazy, we're just seeing a slightly perceptible rise in the number of fatalities.
Berkland says that's a sign the avalanche centers are doing a good job with education and forecasting. Matt Murphy agrees. He's an avalanche forecaster with the Alaska Department of Transportation, who used to work for the Chugach Avalanche Center. He helped organize the conference, which is held every 2 years in a different part of North America. He says it's important to have the conference in Alaska.
Colorado has more avalanche fatalities since the 1950s, but Alaska is number two in that statistic, and that's for overall. And so with a population of only 700,000 people, we have a considerably alarming high rate of avalanche fatalities in the state of Alaska. And this conference brings the state of the art to the avalanche industry.
Murphy says Alaska has a long avalanche season. He says avalanches have hit the Seward Highway as early as November and as late as May. The International Snow Science Workshop runs all week in Anchorage. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly last week approved a land exchange with China Hot Springs Resort. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, owner Bernie Carl can now move ahead on two projects he says he's had in the works for at least 12 years.
Want to build your own ski hill or lease a herd of reindeer? Apparently all it takes is nearly a decade's worth of negotiations to buy 1,460 acres from the Fairbanks North Star Borough. At least that's how things are working out for China Hot Springs Resort owner Bernie Carl.
I like to talk about stuff, but if I tell you I'm going to do something, unless I am dead, I do it.
For the past 12 years, Carl has been working on a plan to bring Alaskan wildlife and downhill skiers to the resort. He says a 4-mile ski run is already in the works.
We have the 4 snowmakers on site. We have the wells already drilled. We have all the piping. We have the grooming machinery already purchased. Already on site, I think we could have some of the earliest and latest skiing in the interior, for sure.
He plans to have the run open next year. Initially, skiers will ride to the top on a small service utility vehicle.
And that's going to have to be the way you go up there for the first season. Until I get an acrylic balloon made, and then you will ride the Aurora to the top of the mountain. It'll be a balloon acrylic filled full of helium. And then it will have 10,000 volts with a little transformer going to it that makes it glow blue. And you will ride to the top of the mountain on a balloon that's glowing like the Aurora.
Carl's currently building an 8-foot fence for 6 reindeer he's leasing from a native Alaskan family in Nenana. He says skiers will glide right by them as they near the bottom of the run.
The fences will be in the trees, and it'll look nice, and the trees will be lit with light-emitting diodes, LEDs, so when you ski down at nighttime, you'll see all of this beautiful, beautiful glow of the lights against the snow, and that's what'll light the ski slopes instead of these ugly big old lights on light poles.
The reindeer are due to arrive at the resort by September 20th. Eventually, Carl says he'd also like to have woodland bison on the property. He says he doesn't have an opening date for the ski run yet, and he isn't sure what a ticket for a ride on his Aurora balloon will cost. But he says pricing will be competitive with 2 other ski hills in the North Star Borough. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis in Delta, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Tony Gorman in Valdez, and Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Falls are the leading cause of workplace fatalities in the construction industry. Your family's well-being depends on you staying healthy during the work season. Employers, for no-cost safety and health consultation and training services, call Alaska Occupational Safety and Health at 1-800-656-4972. This message sponsored by the Alaska Labor Standards and Safety. The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create a second link between the Mat-Su and Anchorage for use during highway closures, emergencies, and as a potential evacuation route. For more facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.